Hello, this is Debbie back with part two of the April 20th, 2016 Decatur Herald and Review E edition, starting as we usually do with the death notices. Decatur, Beta Ezra J. Ezra J. Beta, MD, 88, passed away on Monday, April 18th, 2016, in his home. Ezra will join his son David, who passed away in 2006 in Boulder, Colorado. He had a good life. He enjoyed the practice of medicine, his family and friends. To all who loved him, please know that he's at peace. Memorials may be sent to Decatur Memorial Hospital Cardiology Unit or Donor's Choice. Condolences may be left with the family in care of Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home. Jones, Ricky L., Mount Zion. Ricky L. Rick Jones, 64, Mount Zion, passed away Friday, April 15th, 2016, at St. John's Hospital in Springfield. Services to celebrate Rick's life will be 11 a.m. Friday, April 22nd, at Moran and Goble Funeral Home on Monroe Street in Decatur. Visitation will be from 6 to 8, April 21st, at the funeral home. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials in Rick's honor are suggested to the family in care of Sherry Jones to help with medical expenses. Decatur. Pyle, Mark. Mark Pyle, 68, of Decatur, passed away on Friday, April 15th, 2016, at St. Mary's Hospital. There'll be a memorial service at a later date at Temple B'nai Abraham. Memorials are suggested to Temple B'nai Abraham. The family is being served by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland Avenue in Decatur. Decatur. Cook, Louise. Louise Cook, 97, passed April 15th, 2016, at Symphony of Decatur. Services celebrating Louise's life will be held Saturday, April 23rd, at 11 a.m. with visitation 1 hour before services at Antioch Missionary Baptist Church on Mound Street, on Mound Road, interment Greenwood Cemetery. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Decatur, Davis Curtis Lee. Curtis Lee Davis, 69, of Decatur, passed away in his home on Saturday, April 16th, 2016. The funeral service to honor Mr. Davis will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, April 22nd, at Heartland Community Church on Brush College Road, Decatur. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Decatur, McMillan Judith A. Judith A. McMillan, 72, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away on Friday, April 15th, 2016, in her residence. There'll be no funeral or visitation. It was Judy's request, and anyone who knew her simply smile as they recall the memory and go about and enjoy their day. She'd appreciate a donation to be made for the Homeward Bound Pet Shelter in Decatur. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Decatur, Schnart, James Walter. James Walter Schnart, Charnett, Scharnett, Charnett, 73, of Decatur, went to be with the Savior on Sunday, April 17th, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral service to celebrate James' life will be 11 a.m. Friday, April 22nd, in Metropolitan Baptist Church on Oakland Avenue in Decatur. Visitation will be Thursday, 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, in the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Burial will be in Fairlawn Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Metropolitan Baptist Church Printing Ministry. Decatur, Whiteside, Enid M. Enid M. Whiteside, 95, of Decatur, passed away on Sunday, April 17th, in McKinley Court Nursing Home. Graveside service to celebrate Enid's life will be 10 a.m. Friday, April 22nd, in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Cancer Care Specialists of Central Illinois or Forsyth United Methodist Church. The family of Enid Whiteside is being served by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Decatur, Peters, Jesse B. Jesse B. Peters, Benny, or Jess, 96, died in his sleep on Friday, April 15th, at Wesley Willows Health Center, Rockford, Illinois. Services, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 19th, at Christ United Methodist Church. I guess those were yesterday. Interment will be at a later date. The family's being served by the Sunset Funeral Home and Gardens. And the last one on this page, Decatur, Pensick Terrence L. Terrence L. Pensick, M.D., Ph.D., 68 of Springfield, died at 5:32 p.m. on Monday, April 18, 2016, at St. Joseph's Home. Visitation. Family will receive friends from 4 to 7 on Friday, April 22nd, at St. John's Lutheran Church on Washington in Springfield. Funeral ceremony will be at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, April 23rd, at St. John's Lutheran Church, with Pastors Greg Busboom and Lad Sonneberg officiating. Burial will follow at Oak Hill Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to St. John's Lutheran Church on Washington in Springfield. I was mistaken. We're continuing on to the next page. Lakewood, Dale Hodges. Dale Hodges, 81, of Lakewood, passed away peacefully Monday, April 18, 2016, at Shelby Memorial Hospital in Shelbyville. Visitation will be Thursday, April 21st, from 5 to 8 p.m., with funeral service on Friday, April 22nd, 2016, at 10 a.m., at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelbyville. Burial will be at Ridge Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society. Mount Pulaski, Balding, Elizabeth Ivy. Elizabeth I. Ivy Stotson, Balding, 67, of Springfield, Tennessee, formerly of Mount Pulaski, passed away at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 6th, at Williamson Medical Center in Franklin, Tennessee. Memorial service for Ivy will be held at 6 p.m. Friday, April 22nd, at Fricky Calvert Schrader Funeral Home in Mount Pulaski, with Mark Weber officiating. Visitation will be 2 hours prior to services from 4 to 6 p.m. Private graveside services will be held at Graceland Cemetery in Decatur at a later date. Mowikwa. Shales, Marjorie M. Marjorie M. Shales, 96, of Mowikwa, died April 18th, 2016, in Mowikwa Rehab Center, Rehab and Health Care Center. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Thursday, April 21st, in Sites Funeral Home, Mowikwa. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time. Burial will be in Oddfellows Cemetery, Mowikwa. Memorials may be made to the First United Methodist Church in Mowikwa. Sites Funeral Home, Mowikwa, has been entrusted with care and service arrangements. Sullivan, Blankenberg, K. K. Blankenberg, 94, Sullivan, died 7:50 a.m. Monday, April 18th, in Mason Point, Sullivan. Celebration of Life services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at Sullivan Faith Lutheran Church, with Pastor Paul McGeehy officiating. Burial will be at Green Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour before the funeral at the service. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Lutheran Child Welfare Home, Addison, Illinois, the Sullivan Faith Lutheran Church. Online condolences may be sent to the family at the funeral home. Decatur, Galladay. James Doc Leroy Galladay, 81, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, April 17, 2016. Funeral services to celebrate James' life will be 11 a.m. Thursday, April 21, 2016, at Moran and Goble Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will take place in Point Pleasant Cemetery. Condolences and memories may be shared at the funeral home's website. Decatur, Derlitsky. Lucille Lucy Luscious Lou Derlitsky, 95, of Springfield, formerly of Decatur, passed away Saturday, April 16, 2016, in Mount Vale Retirement Center. Services to celebrate Lucille's life will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, April 22nd, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland Avenue in Decatur. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the services. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. Decatur, Bochenschutz. Karen Irene Bochenschutz. I'm going to spell that. B-U-E-C-H-S-E-N-S-C-H-U-E-T-Z. Bochenschutz, 71, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, April 17, 2016. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 Thursday, April 21st at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Funeral service to celebrate her life will be 10 a.m. Friday, April 22nd at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Decatur, following a one-hour visitation at the church. A graveside service will follow at 2 p.m. at Nokomis Cemetery, Nokomis, Illinois. Memorials are suggested to Lutheran School Association or Alzheimer's Association. Kenny Cutright, Charles W. Charles W. Cutright, 77, at Kenny, Illinois, passed away at 12:45 a.m. April 19th at his residence surrounded by family. Services will be 11 a.m. Friday, April 22nd at Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton, with Ernie Harvey, Jr. officiating. Burial will be followed at the Pleasant Valley Cemetery, Kenny, Illinois. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 Friday at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to Little Galilee Christian Assembly or Safe Haven Hospice. Bement, Nelson Burr. Burr Nelson, 66, passed away at home on Saturday, April 16th in Bement. Burr was born in Chicago, Illinois. A private family remembrance will be scheduled at a future date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Piatt County Animal Shelter in Monticello or Homeward Bound Pet Center in Decatur. The family of Burr Nelson is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home in Decatur. And that ends the obituaries for Wednesday, April 20th, 2016, in the Herald and Review e-edition. On a lighter note, on the same page, crosswalk turned into keyboard, Kalamazoo, Michigan, from AP. Some crosswalks in downtown Kalamazoo are being transformed to look like piano keys ahead of a big musical event. The Gilmore International Keyboard Festival takes place April 26th to May 14th. Festival organizers worked with Michigan Department of Transportation and the city to install the three temporary crosswalks. Crosswalks usually have blank roadway between white stripes. Now they've updated to look like big piano keys on the road. Paul Keene, a PK contract, was among those who worked Monday on installation for the project. Continuing in business, a peek into the mysterious art of citrus flavoring, Riverside, California. Jeff Marshall Hills finds a tango mandarin scent a bit catty. He can't even imagine a market for the Indio Mandarin Quat, but the rich wine and berry undertones of the Sanguinelli Blood Orange elicits a string of superlatives. He wanders a dusty orchard here about 50 miles east of Los Angeles, surrounded by co-workers who watch each morsel that goes in his mouth and heed every bon mot, B-O-N-M-O-T, bon mot, that comes out. Because when it comes to taste, this 57-year-old Brit has the kind of palate that can influence the worldwide market in food and beverages. Marshall Hill is a principal flavorist for Givaudan, the largest manufacturer of flavorings and fragrances in the world. The Swiss company has dispatched its flavorists to jungles in Gabon and to vanilla farms in Madagascar. But it always comes back to these 22 acres near the rocky flanks of Mount Ribido, which harbor a taster's menu of more than 1,000 varieties of citrus collected, cultivated, and crossbred for more than a century by the University of California at Riverside. Who knew? It's a living genetic library stretching from Abhayapuri, A-B-H-A-Y-A-P-U-R-I, Abba Apuri lime to Azulian sour orange, and in 10 years, Marshall Hill and his colleague have sampled only about 20% of it. On this day, they'll explore about a dozen more in search of something that will pique the palates of consumers and keep the company atop one of the most opaque and cutthroat niches in the food industry. Last year, Givaudan forked over $1 million to UC Riverside for the privilege, creating the Givaudan Citrus Variety Collection Endowed Chair. The current occupant, Tracy Kahn, K-A-H-N, longtime curator of the collection, greets Marshall Hill with a mother-of-pearl-handled grapefruit knife. She pairs open a tango mandarin, a variety developed at Riverside that now grows on several million trees statewide. You probably have eaten it because it's what you find in cutie and halo boxes, she explained. Those are the trademark names for what usually are multiple cultivars. Clementines before Christmas, usually fine Fina Sodia clementines or clemenules. Then after Christmas, the W. Murcott a furor in tango, but mostly tango. Marshall Hill flexes the rind, releasing an oily mist below his nose, and inhales. This one's quite sulfury. It's a bit catty. Cat's pee, he says. Not necessarily a bad thing. It's something you normally associate with grapefruit. Quite often with a fresh peel, it brings a very slight twinge to the profile. As for the fruit itself, is particularly succulent, particularly juicy, all the standard descriptions we'd use, but is there anything that's standing out? No, it's just a really well-balanced Mandarin-type profile. This is pretty mainstream, but delicious. Marshall Hill, a brawny man who sports a Celtic cross on his right biceps, approaches his job with self-effacing humor. All he wanted was enough money for a car when he applied for a flavorist job 40 years ago at an essential oils company in his native Milton Keynes, about 45 miles northwest of London. Several mergers and acquisitions later, he's risen to the top tier of tasters at the top company in the field. Except for a few years at the company's North American headquarters in Cincinnati, though, Marshall Hill has mostly stayed in his hometown, a planned city that is famous lately for having the highest percentage of overweight or obese people in England. I don't consider myself a very sensitive taster, Marshall Hill said. I don't want to be a sensitive taster because most of the population aren't sensitive tasters. What I think sometimes doesn't even matter at all. It's what consumers think. What consumers think about taste, though, is founded mostly on misconceptions. To the layperson, when they're talking about taste, they're talking about the experience of when they eat, drink, or otherwise put it in their mouth. And that's not just taste, said Janine Delwich, a New York-based sensory scientist and consultant who has worked in academia and industry. When scientists talk about taste, they're talking about an experience cobbled together as much from scent, suggestion, and memory as from the nerve endings in the mouth and tongue, which detect only sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and savory umami of meats. There is some debate about a sixth fat sensation. I'll read that last sentence, which is also a paragraph of this section, and that ends this article. When scientists talk about taste, they're talking about an experience cobbled together as much from scent, suggestion, and memory as from the nerve endings in the mouth and tongue, which detect only sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and savory umami of meats. Parenthetical comment, there is some debate about a sixth fat sensation. End of article. Next article in the D section, Save Lives, Become an Organ Donor. This is by Stephanie Stewart from the Tribune News Service. Someone you are related to, someone you work with, or someone you know may be waiting for an organ transplant. According to the United Network for Organ Sharing, more than 123,000 people currently need life-saving organ transplants. And although there have been advances in medical technology and donations, the demand for organ, eye and tissue donation still greatly exceeds the number of donors. I see how these numbers impact people, patients, and their families almost every day. Patients in need of a transplant remain hopeful. Their families think about and pray every day for an organ to become available to help save their loved one. I have spent 10 years helping people who are waiting for a kidney transplant, and seeing the gift of an organ donor still leaves me speechless. Families of the organ recipient always ask for ideas and suggestions for how they can express their never-ending thanks for the gift so freely given. Yet, despite best intentions and the widespread availability of factual information, inaccuracies and misinformation about organ donations persist. Anyone can be a potential donor, regardless of age, race, or medical history. All major religions in the U.S. support organ, eye, and tissue donation. There is no cost to the donor or their family for organ or tissue donation. The decision to be an organ and tissue donor is a powerful one. I often hear from donor families that their loved one's donation was the one positive thing that came out of a terrible tragedy. Many families say that knowing their loved one helped save and heal lives gave them great comfort and strength during their time of grief. Many resources are available for people considering the life-giving gift of organ donation. In my view, one of the best is mayoclinic.org, where you can search for facts about organ donation, transplant surgery, and the latest innovations in organ transplantation. Another good source is LifeSource. That's one word, L-I-F-E, capital S-O-U-R-C. CE, a nonprofit organization serving people across Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and parts of Wisconsin. They work with hospitals and other community partners to support donor families and encourage people to register as donors. For more information about LifeSource, you can reach them at lifesource.org or call them 1-888-5-DONATE toll-free. I strongly urge you and your family members to discuss this important topic and consider saving lives. Become an organ donor. End of that. In the same vein, no pun intended, in a much shorter article, Red Cross, give blood, save a life. The American Red Cross encourages eligible donors to make an appointment to give blood and help save lives in honor of World Red Cross and Red Crescent Day. Each year, the local and global impact of the Red Cross mission is celebrated on May 8th, the birthday of International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement founder Henri Dunant. Currently, donors of all blood types are needed to give and help save hospital patients' lives. Every day, the Red Cross must collect approximately 14,000 blood donations to meet the needs of patients across the country. To make an appointment or give blood, download the free Red Cross blood donor app or visit the Red Cross web or call your local Red Cross. And our state news. Coal tax pitched as good for Illinois, dwindling coffers. Belt by AP. That is B-E-N-L-D. I don't think I've ever heard that town name before. Beld. B-E-N-L-D. AP. It's been more than 60 years since the last coal mine closed in the southwest Illinois town of Belt, but its legacy is found in the name of high school teams, the Miners, and its economic development promoting arm, the Coal Country Chamber of Commerce. The long dormant mines also rear their heads at random intervals, causing cave-ins that have damaged dozens of homes and led to the demolition of a nearly new elementary school in 2009. The budget to repair city services after cave-ins, such as a municipal water line that burst when the sinking ground damaged foundations of 15 homes 1 year ago in this 1,500-person town, is slim. So, when an environmental group came to town to pitch a severance tax on coal mined in Illinois that could potentially raise hundreds of million dollars annually for the cash-strapped state and funnel some to Belt, Mayor Gloria Sidar and colleagues were eager to listen. I don't think it's a bad thing, actually, to ask somebody to pay a tax that would then go into a fund to help alleviate some of these problems, she said. Illinois is one of just three coal-producing states that doesn't collect excise tax on fossil fuels that are extracted or severed from the ground, including oil and natural gas. However, the proposal would need to overcome likely vociferous opposition from the struggling coal industry and also require legislative approval. At the time, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Democratic leaders haven't reached an agreement on a budget for the current fiscal year. Organizers said they're working to line up legislative sponsors for 2017 rather than push lawmakers during an election year to support a 5% tax hike on the gross value of the nearly 58 million tons produced by coal companies in Illinois in 2014. They're also taking their message to former and current coal communities such as Belt in Macoupin County, about 50 miles northeast of St. Louis, Canton, which is near Peoria, and West Frankfort near the southern tip of the state. The tax could have raised $140 million last year alone, and eventually more than $200 million annually, and the state's coal output is expected to increase. According to research conducted on behalf of the environmental nonprofit group Community Futures Initiative, the money would be funneled evenly to three sources: the state's general revenue fund, a permanent mineral trust fund to pay for future public services beyond the shelf life of mines, beneficial for places like Belt and coal-producing communities. Coal companies that mine here in Illinois are extracting the state's wealth, said Champaign environmental activist Pam Rickert, a leader of the initiative. Most of the energy generated at Prairie State relies on coal shipped from elsewhere, according to federal statistics, while roughly 80% of the high sulfur coal mined here is sent out of state, including overseas markets. Illinois coal officials contend that any new tax would further weaken the already reeling industry. Last week, St. Louis-based Peabody Energy, which is the nation's largest coal miner and operates three mines in southern Illinois, filed for bankruptcy protection. An increase in costs, such as severance tax, will obviously make our companies less competitive, said Illinois Coal Association President Phil Gannett, who also dismissed the impact of a severance tax on state finances as minimal. The conversation isn't a new one. A similar proposal failed to pass the state house by one vote in 1984, according to the Southern Illinois paper in Carbondale. More recently, former Governor Pat Quinn's administration considered the prospect. The Belt City Council is on board with the tax proposal, voting unanimously Monday to endorse a symbolic resolution in favor of it. Sider and her city council colleagues have more modest but no less pressing budget concerns, emergency repairs due to cave-ins. End of that article. In Champaign, U of Illinois non-tenured faculty began a two-day strike. This is out of AP. Champaign, the union that represents non-tenured faculty at the U of I, started a two-day strike Tuesday in its quest for a contract, but top school administrators said the walkout is not the right approach. Members of the non-tenure track faculty coalition, Local 6546, expressed hope their strike would help speed up contract negotiations that have dragged on since October 2014. Shortly after the state first recognized the union as a bargaining unit, the contract would be the group's first with the university. A few dozen union members picketed throughout the day Tuesday outside the English building on the Urbana-Champaign campus. The union represents about 500 people, but it was not immediately clear how many classes were called off or otherwise affected. This is our chance to show our united strength and value on campus, Christina D'Angelo, an instructor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, and a union official, wrote on the group's Facebook page. But Interim Chancellor Barbara Wilson and Interim Provost Edward Fieser said in an emailed statement Tuesday that while they appreciate the faculty members, their union should work with the university through an already appointed federal mediator. This two-day strike seeks to demonstrate what we already know and believe, but it does not help us make progress together, the statement read. Non-tenured faculty work on short-term contracts and want longer-term deals based on years of service, 2 years contracts after 5 years services, and 3 years for 10 years of service. Wilson and Fieser said they support longer contracts, but based on merit and at the discretion of the individual departments. Faculty members at many universities across the country have complained in recent years about the growing reliance on non-tenured instructors who often make less money. End of that article. Again, in state news, audit slams oversight of Quinn anti-violence programs. This is AP out of Springfield. A state audit has found the anti-violence programs administered by former Governor Pat Quinn lost nearly $4 million in questionable expenses or unspent funds never collected. The review released Tuesday by Auditor General Frank Martino covered three programs designed to fight violence, including the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative that Quinn's office developed in 2010 as he was running for election to a full term. Questions about program spending helped defeat his 2014 re-election bid. The audit found problems with how grant recipients were chosen, how contracts were written, how spending was monitored, and how unspent funds went uncollected. John Mackey is director of the Criminal Justice Information Authority under current Governor Bruce Rauner. He says the agency accepts the findings and is making improvements. End of that article. Again, out of the state. Bill would make labs offer research beagles for adoption. Again, AP out of Springfield. Furry, four-legged lobbyists visited the Illinois State Capitol to support legislation that would require research dogs and cats a chance at adoption. Beagles rescued by the Beagle Freedom Project appeared Tuesday with their rescuers in favor of legislation introduced by Republican Representative Margo McDermott of Mokena and Democratic Senator Linda Holmes of Aurora. The measure would require labs, particularly universities and other tax-supported facilities, to work with organizations to give animals a chance at adoption rather than being euthanized. Beagles are often used in research because they're docile and small. The plan has no enforcement mechanism. Supporters say it would rely on labs to identify healthy animals eligible for new homes. That's the end of that article. A quick event note as we close section 2 of the Decatur paper. Tomorrow's highlight, Spring Beginners Class, 7 to 9 p.m., Decatur Genealogical Society, Decatur. $25, and you call them at 429-0135, 429-0135. The Spring Beginners Class for the Decatur Genealogical Society tomorrow evening at 429-0135. That brings to an end the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, April 20th, 2016. This is Debbie saying good day for now and talk to you again soon.